All right, make sure you're in fellowship here as we continue on in chapter 43, verses 32 through 34 of Genesis, looking at the nice little luncheon that Joseph is giving for his staff and for the Hebrews. Tongue-in-cheek, obviously, it's a feast. Everything's first class when it comes to taking care of the second most powerful person in the world. And we see that the seating arrangements shows a discrimination or separation, segregation among rank and file between Joseph and his staff, obviously, in that vein. But that the Hebrews are segregated completely alone, apart from and away from all the other Egyptians, including the staff. And the reason being is that to the Egyptians, the Hebrews, to eat with them was an abomination in their eyes. It was detestable. And this noun, toh evah, we're looking at its meaning. And we saw, first of all, that it looks at something spurned, looked down upon, based on custom or ideology. We have a couple of other verses that relate the Egyptians to the Hebrews in this regards, such as they detested shepherds, the Egyptians did, foreign shepherds in regards to being in the land in this respect. And certain animal sacrifices they found detestable in regards to the Hebrews in that vein. When it comes to God, we see some of those things that are considered an abomination before God. Among that, certain sexual sins such as homosexuality, bestiality, etc. And it's a warning to the nations that permit this type of vice to occur and exist and flourish in their countries, that they will eventually meet God's judgment as a nation. And that's one of the reasons why many of the nations were conquered and destroyed by the conquest generation going into the land, as God used the Hebrews as a whipping post, if you will, in that respect. And point 15, page 35 of our notes, we see that the noun is also described those things associated with idolatry, to worship idols. Deuteronomy 7, 25 and 26. Again, these are all warnings to Israel not to fall in the same traps as their surrounding pagan nation neighbors do. And idolatry, obviously, is their form, general form of worship from the Gentile nations. Verse 25, the graven images of their gods you are to burn with fire. They are to destroy all of their religious places of worship. When they go in and conquer the land, they are not to allow these things to even exist in structure. Fire, obviously, is symbolic of judgment in that regards. You will not covet or lust the silver or the gold that is on them. Much of idolatry is about obtaining wealth, money, the monetary trend in regards to life. And they are not even to abscond whatever valuable metals that may be used in the formation of their idols and things of this nature, or in the form of their particular worship, nor take it for yourselves. You are to leave it and let it burn, and basically, obviously, it's not going to destroy a fire, will not, but to let it go back to the earth, etc. In that regards, not to utilize it for their own purposes, nor take it for yourselves, verse 25, unless you be snared by it. This appeals to the STA to let your mind wander away from your true goal and
vision and focus in regards to why you're on doctrine, and become wrapped up in regards to money and things of this thing, things of this nature, things of this life, as we will see, as we have already brought out in regards to corrective translation, money being one of the motivating factors of why we have a translation in our Bible today that we got to deal with and correct. So to be snared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord your God. So that which is detestable, disgusting, if you will, an abomination, God abhors it. And you will not bring an abomination to your house. You don't embrace these things. Like you go to Mexico and buy one of their phallic gods and bring it back and put it in your house. You know, set it up. Oh, isn't this a nice conversation piece? Oh, great. Or any other form of idolatry, the sun god, Ra, and all this other stuff. You're not to have those types of things. That is not a proper witness. He said, not even bring it into your house and like it come under the ban to be separated from, if you will. You will utterly detest it, and you should utterly abhor it, for it is something banned. It is something that God considers illegal, prohibited, see. Instead of bracing and catering to these things of idolatrous type of worship, religiosity, things of this nature, you should detest it. The Fundy lifestyle should not be appealing to you, to put it mildly. In regards to that aspect that obviously is erroneous, following human viewpoint and idolatry in its own right. 12:29-31, Deuteronomy. When the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations which you are going in to dispossess, exhortation to the conquest, and you shall dispossess them and dwell on their land. And beware, verse 30, that you are not instead to follow them after they are destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods, that I also may do likewise? You shouldn't even really dabble in regards to the occultic and paganistic affairs in that respect. What's your interest? Truly, what is your interest? If it's for purpose of apologetics or something of that nature, yeah, I can see that. You know, to practice Zen Buddhism or some other type of erroneous cultic paganology, there's no purpose for it, really. But not as an adjusted believer. To pursue these things, you stay away from it. You apply the doctrine of separation. Verse 31. See, the caveat is that you're studying it so that you can imitate it, that I may that I also may do likewise. At verse 31, you will not behave thus toward the Lord your God, for every abominable act which the Lord hates they have done for their gods, and they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Child sacrifice is practiced. While it may not be quite so mystic, the same type of ideology is still practiced today in certain sects, in certain societies. Sacrifice your children so that you can try to enter illegally into another land. What's the purpose of that? We'll get rich. If you keep up with the news, you know what I'm talking about. 13:12-17. If you hear one of your cities, Israel, which the Lord your God has given you to live in, as the land would be divided up among the tribes of the sons of Jacob. To live in. Anyone saying, verse 13, some worthless men. It's worthless. It does nothing to advance oneself spiritually. Have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods whom you have not known. In other words, to introduce, solicit any type of false teaching. Any type of false teaching. In verse 14, and this obviously is under a national priesthood. The Mosaic Law is designed to be used civilly as a nation for Israel in this regard. So their civil environment, law enforcement, if you will. In verse 14, you shall investigate and search out and inquire thoroughly. And if it is true, in the matter established that this abomination has been done among you, then verse 15, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it and all that is in it, and its cattle with the edge of the sword. And wipe them out. Wipe them out. One of these days, and not that it hasn't been done to a certain degree through Israel's history, David would have enforced these types of laws. That's one reason why people didn't like him. He had his STA, but he was committed and loyal to the law, the Mosaic Law, in regards to ruling over the land of Israel. And people don't like that. People don't like to see murderers killed, certain people, certain types, or sexual violators and things of this nature. But as it was, they were to go in, and if you had a congregation of people that were going that route, then you're to annihilate them, including all their possessions, their cattle. Well, why kill the poor cow? It's cursing by association. You don't leave anything in that regards. But then you shall gather all its booty into the middle of this open square, verse 16, and burn the city and all its booty with fire as a whole burnt offering to the Lord your God, and will be a ruin forever. It shall never be rebuilt. It's all symbolic. That we worship God and God alone. There will be no other gods before me. That's one of the commandments. See, God is obviously a jealous God. Either you serve Him or else you come on the retribution side of God. It's not without its righteousness attached to it. What other God are you going to serve? You show me another God that is perfect and absolute in all that He is. Show me one. You can't. None other exists. And if something is perfect, where else are you going to look? Why would you trade? Yeah. A Lamborghini for a Pacer, you know. Why? All right, enough of that. Oh, verse 17, let me finish it up here. Nothing from that which is put under the ban will cling to your hand, in order that the Lord may turn from His burning anger and show mercy to you and have compassion on you and make you increase just as He swore to your fathers. These are warnings given to Israel and other nations, while they may not be as culpable as Israel to that degree. They still are culpable before God ultimately. And while you may think, oh, why doesn't God get certain nations out there and let them exist? Well, God knows all things. He knows in the hearts of men. And some of these nations actually have better moral standards in regards to their civil laws in enforcement of it than even our Christian nation does. Like still recognizing homosexuality for what it is. But anyway, that was verse 15, especially verse 15 there. And then there's many other verses that use this term in regards to idolatry. 16, it describes unclean animals in the dietary code. Looking at it from that perspective, obviously we're looking at the fact of other verses that the Egyptians detested shepherds, foreign shepherds, and animal sacrifice, as we saw by Moses' words. Deuteronomy 14, 3 and following. You will not eat any detestable thing. And it gives a list of clean and unclean animals. Clean and unclean animals. And all this is symbolic. While there may be some other dietary benefit to it, it has to be figured out individually on each of the others. We're not under a dietary code in the church. Anything we can eat anything we want, whether it's a tarantula with bear grills on his deal or whatever, you know, as long as it's sanctified and set apart for God. The only thing that we're commanded not to do is drink blood. So for all you vampires out there, knock it off. And some of the clean animals, ox, sheep, goat, deer, gazelle, roebuck. I think they're akin to sears. Yeah, that was bad. That's a dad joke, sorry. The wild goat, the ibex, whatever that is, the antelope, and the mountain sheep. The unclean animals, such as those that divide the hoof, and has the hoof split in two and chews the cud, those that you can eat. They're clean animals, among animals that you may eat. Nevertheless, you are not to eat of those among those which chew the cud, or among those that divide the hoof in two. The camel, the rabbit, the rock badger, for though they chew the cud, they do not divide the hoof. They are unclean for you. So you'd have to go through and figure out the symbolism between with all of these, which I don't know if anybody's ever done that in its complete form or not. But anyway, for our intents and purposes, unclean animals are seen to be an abomination. And that's because of their symbolic significance of being unclean, which unclean represents sin, spiritual dereliction before God. 17, moving on here, it is used of those that condemn sin towards others, supposed as under God's wrath. In Psalm 88:8, so in a negative sense, it can show a form of arrogance, if you will. Looking down upon somebody to condescend that as they have judged someone as well, God's after them. So they're detestable. Psalm 88:8. Throw that one into the mix. Here is a song from the sons of Korah. It's kind of a lament, if you will, under divine discipline. He has his prayer and recalling as things may have occurred in his life, the believer, you have removed, verse 8, that my acquaintance is far from me. People have given him arms distance. You have made me an object of loathing to them, repulsive, that's our term, an abomination. And I am shut up and I cannot go out. So
So they've been quarantined. maybe it's a case of leper. I don't know. Something of that nature. But there's our term. And people look upon them and immediately judge them and look down upon someone because of their state of affairs as they see how they think God is acting or interacting with them under divine discipline, things of that nature. Now there is some debate among scholars as to why the prohibition in our present context. Can we determine exactly why they truly think the Hebrews here are detestable to them? And there's some debate about that. Professor Jan Osman, I'll pronounce it that way, and Dr. Rabbi Zeb Farber all right, that sounds like that should be in a movie somewhere, but anyway, these two professors at the symposium, point 19, the symposium titled Envisaging the Exodus Story, Meet the Egyptians, in an article that they wrote called, quote, Shepherds and Eating with Hebrews, an Abomination to the Egyptians, which you can find this article, in, reference to it in the Torah.com on the website. This is a direct quote out of their article, state, quote, the claim that the Egyptians won't sit with the Hebrews is striking. In the New Kingdom and earlier, the Egyptian dynasties, in which the story of Joseph is set, no record exists of any such taboo. The Egyptians did have dietary restrictions, but no social restrictions about table fellowship. End quotes. However, we do have other external sources that point to their prejudice or segregation of such. In point 20, the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia records Herodotus, chapter 2, page 41, saying the Egyptians would not kiss a Greek on the mouth, which in our society men don't do that, but other societies they still do, or use his dish as a mean of greetings, or use his dish, or taste meat cut with the knife of a Greek. They won't even partake of food that may have come in contact with a utensil used by a Greek. All right, so 21, the most practical interpretation in our verse was because of dietary codes and ceremonial practice of the Egyptians. So I'll try to explain this here, best my ability. 22, they considered themselves ceremonially defiled if they ate with those that otherwise sacrificed animals that to them were to be worshipped, as we read in Genesis 46, 30. Verse 34, that as Joseph warned his brothers, gave them a heads up, tell the Pharaoh that you're a rancher, not a shepherd, because shepherds are detestable, foreign shepherds are detestable to them. So that tells you that there has something to do with the animals that they're involved with. In regards to this prejudice. So 23, now our author Moses
would be intimately familiar with Egyptian custom in this regards, in spite of any lack of external evidence otherwise, whether one finds it in an external source of history. Moses, who wrote the Pentateuch, was groomed in the Egyptian dynasties. He was groomed as he became the adopted child of Pharaoh's daughter to step into place and to rule in Egypt. And as we know, he went on positive volition. And instead, he renounced his Egyptian heritage, and he became God's pastor teacher, if you will, over the Exodus generation, leading them out of Israel in fulfillment of prophecy. So he would be of authors, historical authors. He would be definitely in tune of what's kosher, as we would might say, or not, in the Egyptian customs. And along those vein, point 24, not all national customs are necessarily inscribed in ink for posterity, written down in the history books, as they would just be assumed as a natural behavior in many cases. There are some customs that you don't find in the history books, but people have just been practicing them over and over and over for years, and it's just part of the lifestyle for them. Then, so they're not going to even really think about. I mean, there's certain customs in certain even parts of our country that you don't go into somebody's house that you don't know barefooted, or they take offense to it. And I've run across that back in my old hippie days down south, having to walk into the house, and it was hot out, summertime, barefooted. I went barefooted often. And was going to ask the young lady out for go out and run around with the church crowd. And I was barefooted, and after I went out, they wouldn't let her go because I was barefooted. I didn't know, but I obviously violated this. It was a custom. Up here, you don't walk in a house in the wintertime with your shoes on, or at least you take them off because you don't want to get snow and salt and everything else on the carpet. So go figure. I didn't want to date that girl anyway. But anyway, that was embarrassing. It goes to show that, you know, that if you're not informed, you can do things and not even be aware of it. So 25. Now, one of the most important animal cults was the bull cult in the Egyptian writings as far back as the first dynasty, which would have been dated around 2500 BC. And we're down in 12th dynasty, 14th dynasty, 1600 or so BC. Compare Exodus 24:5. We know Israel, that was part of their ritual of offering a bull cattle as a burnt offering. He sent young men and sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to Yahweh. So that was an area that Israel would utilize this animal. In their ritual sacrifice. Whereas in Egypt, the bull would be worshipped, not unlike what you find in India and other places of the country today, of the world today. People are starving to death, and they got all kinds of protein running around that they can't kill it because they're going to worship it instead. So 26, the Egyptians were known for deifying many kinds of animals, to include sheep and rams, which obviously is another animal utilized in the custom of ritual under the Mosaic law by the Israelites. Israelites, by the Hebrews. So what we might conclude here, at least to a certain degree, 27, they have become legalistic and determined that to even eat with a foreigner that did not subscribe to their polytheism rendered them unclean. To even eat with someone who does not worship the same animals that they worship. It wasn't just enough that they wouldn't eat the food that they sacrificed to their animal, to their god, but not to even to eat with one. And we see a sense of legalism that has entered into even this occultic paganism that Egypt practiced. It's not hard to go that direction. They want to, under religiosity, religions want to build up their religion. They want to make themselves look more important. And legalism easily is insipid in regards to entering in regards to their practices. We stay away from legalism. We don't have to build up our faith. Our faith is presented just as it is, and it's built up enough on its own. So they had the conclusion here we can draw from at least one is that they had become legalistic. And while obviously there's a custom even among the Hebrews not to eat animals sacrificed to idols, the Egyptians took it a step farther. You don't even eat with the person who sacrificed an animal that we might otherwise worship. 28, hence they segregated themselves at the table. If they did that, they considered themselves to be unclean, not worthy before their God, disgusting. And hence they looked at the other people as being disgusting. See. So 29, while the Egyptians were known to eat beef and other meats. This is part of found in historical archives in regards to Egyptian history. So while the Egyptians were known to eat beef and other meats, it was only acceptable if it was sacrificed to one of their gods. So 30, it was not that they condescended to foreigners per se, but it was their deplorable religious habits and sacrifice that were deemed disgusting. And hence the foreigner was seen to be an extension of that. And hence, you don't eat with them because it's going to render you unclean. Their legalistic twist to it. On the other end of the coin, point 31, if one moved to Egypt, a foreigner, and resided there, assimilating into their culture, the stigma was removed. So if one from Canaan or wherever came in, decided to settle down in Egypt, wanted to become a shepherd, be a shepherd in Egypt. The fact that they were part now of the assimilated into the culture in and of itself, then you would not find this practice of prejudice in regards to table fellowship that we're seeing here on this occasion with the visiting Hebrews in Joseph's home. So if one moved to Egypt and resided there assimilating into their culture, the stigma was removed. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they had to follow even their pagan rituals. It's just racial prejudice that you're seeing come about in regards to their attitude. If you're an Egyptian citizen, that's good enough. See. 32, this explains the acceptance by the Egyptians for Joseph, whom they knew to be Hebrew. When the butler came out and told Pharaoh, back in chapter 41, verse 12, of the Hebrew that interpreted his dreams for him, he made it very clear of what race Joseph was. So they knew he was a Hebrew. Now, one might say, well, a Pharaoh, promoted him to vizier, so everybody had to accept him, etc. Still, I guarantee you, Pharaoh followed custom. He followed protocol in regards to how they make all this work. See. And that was by himself doing things that would give his people a reason to accept him as an Egyptian. And that's point 33. His assimilation was formally ratified when he married into the Egyptian priesthood. In 41-45, we saw back then that Pharaoh gave to Joseph a wife. And this particular wife was a daughter of an Egyptian priest. And it was a formal ratification of assimilating him into an otherwise pagan society. But I guarantee you, Joseph didn't practice paganism. There's some commentators out there that want to try to lay that on him. I have not seen that one bit. In fact, what you see is him evangelizing in the midst of this paganism. Hence, the house steward and the doctrine he throws at in shade towards Joseph's brothers in that regard. Then the Pharaoh named Joseph. First he gave him an Egyptian name. This is all part of the protocol of assimilating into the Egyptian society. Zaphnath Paneah, and they gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, one of the pagan cults, as his wife. And Joseph went forth all the land of Egypt. So, bottom line, they became legalistic in their practice of table fellowship, and that if someone was not assimilated into the culture and otherwise sacrificed animals for their own gods, it rendered that person unclean, and you rendered you unclean by coming in contact with them, imbibing in food. All right, so 34. Now in the seating arrangement, as we move on here, the brothers' table faced Joseph's. End quote. They were seated before him. So you'd have Joseph in his standalone table, his staff at their own table, probably to his side, one side or both. And then right in front of Joseph, you had the other table set up with seating all on one side facing him. All the brothers seated on one side of the table facing Joseph. So then in the seating arrangement, the brothers' table faced Joseph, and they were seated before him, Yeshab Lamed Panah, seated before his presence, before his face. 35, Joseph obviously wanted to be able to readily observe all of his brothers together. He wanted a panoramic view of all 11 of his brothers, just by looking up and basically one glance, rather than have to turn or look around, look over, as it may be, people down the line from you, and other people are shoving food in their face and you can't see down there, you know, whatever. He wanted to be able to see them all. He wanted to be able to readily observe them. And that's because of the whole situation that he set up on this thing. And the first one is the seating arrangement, how that came about. So that's point 36. One reason implied by the text was the washed expressions on their face via the uniqueness of their seating order. Quote, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. Ha-Bekor, Kaf-Bekora, Wa-Ha-Tesir, Kaf-Tesira. So 37, they were seated in sequence to their chronological birth, from the oldest to the youngest, from Simeon to Benjamin. 38, now some commentaries take issue with Joseph having prearranged the seating, since the text does not specifically state that. In other words, they want to leave room that just somehow they all sat down in this order. But I'm not buying it. 39, this view glosses over the servants, first of all, being in charge of seating, verse 32, and serving the guests. The servants would have naturally seated them in their proper places. So it was by design, not by some luck, if you want to use that term. They were told how to seat people. They were given explicit instructions. See, things weren't left to doubt for servants to figure stuff out generally on their own unless, you know, authority told them to. They were told exactly how everything was supposed to be done accordingly. So 40 servants of those days did what they were told. Find a good waiter and waitress today that has this type of discipline in regards to their service. They definitely deserve a tip. I've had better waiters and waitresses at buffets than I have at some high-class restaurants. Yes, sir. You can go to the buffet now anytime you'd like. Thank you. Then you get somebody else. But anyway. 41. Already we have seen this to support the direction we're going with this. Already we have seen that Joseph and staff played mind games with these men. With the return silver. Nothing else is a mind game, even though there may not have been any necessary malintent. Still messing with them. Binding Simeon before their eyes. That Joseph just goes in and does that out of clear blue. Hey, he's messing with them. It's a psych game. So we've seen this go on, and there's no reason, as I point out here, point 41, to think differently now. No, he's messing with them. This whole thing is to set them up. Shoot a little bit ahead. We get to the end of the verses. They all got drunk that night. And that next morning, the Hebrew language makes it clear that they were basically told to get up at dawn and hit the road. So in a condition of a party night of drinking, they got to hit the road the next morning. And that's when he pulls this whole prank, this scheme in regards to Operation Silver Cup. And what better way to do it? They're kind of gray and heads in the cloud at best after heavy drinking like that. And they're probably not going to check their bags again or anything when they take off. You would think, well, the first time they took off, you know, how did this money get here the first time? You'd think, well, this time, well, let's check our bags before we leave. No. Who's going to think about it when you get up like that? I don't want to go. I want to sleep. You know? Anyway, I talk like I've been there before. I haven't, but I have some real good friends that have. And they told me about this. I lied. All right, I'll rebound that. So, first of all, he wants to see their reaction when they realize how they were seated. So they were told, the servants obviously were told to seat him in such arrangement. So 42, obviously Joseph would know the order of their births. 43, it has its desired effect. Quote, and the men looked at one another in astonishment. While Thama ha ish ish el rea, end quotes. So 44, the Hebrew verb here, thama, translated astonishment, has an element of unexpected fear. And let's just call it right there. Good break to come back Tuesday and finish this up. Father, again, thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God and the Holy Spirit to continue to enlighten us these things. In Jesus' name, amen.